From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today we hear from composer Nicholas Britell. His score for the film If Beale Street Could Talk is nominated for an Oscar. He also wrote the score for Vice, which is nominated for Best Picture. And he wrote the score for Moonlight. He wants his scores to help you lose yourself in films.
Music can have so much power, but you have to be careful with that power.
Before Britell was a successful film composer, he nearly became a concert pianist. He was in a hip-hop band. He worked as a currency trader on Wall Street. And he composed telephone hold music.
And I wrote this kind of almost like spa-like music. And all my friends would call this restaurant and ask to be placed on hold.
Also, John Powers reviews the Netflix series Black Earth Rising about a woman orphaned in the Rwandan genocide. First News. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, composer Nicholas Britell, is nominated for an Oscar for his score for the film If Beale Street Could Talk. He wrote the score for Vice, which is nominated for Best Picture, and his score for Moonlight was nominated for an Oscar. He also wrote the music for The Big Short, Adam McKay's comedy explaining the financial crisis of 2007 and 2008. When McKay asked Britell to compose the music, McKay didn't know that Britell had formerly worked as a currency trader at Bear Stearns and was fluent in the language of Wall Street. Other music by Britell you might know include the theme for the HBO series Succession and spirituals and work songs he wrote for the film 12 Years a Slave. Britell had once planned to be a classical concert pianist. He studied at Juilliard's pre-college program. At Harvard, he studied psychology and the neuropsychology of music, how music works on our brain and therefore our emotions. Let's start with a scene from If Beale Street Could Talk, which is adapted from the James Baldwin novel of the same name, set in Harlem in the early 70s. The main characters, a 19-year-old woman, Tish, and a 22-year-old man, Fonny, have become lovers after being best friends since childhood. But they're forced to communicate from opposite sides of thick glass after he's wrongly accused of rape and sent to jail. In a flashback scene, she's on the subway with Fonny, thinking about the time when they were young children and took baths together. Listen for Britell's underscoring, the music underneath the voiceover.
I don't remember that we ever had any curiosity concerning each other's bodies. Fonny loved me too much. And that meant that there had never been any occasion for shame between us. We were a part of each other, flesh of each other's flesh, which we so took for granted that we never thought of the flesh. And yet, it was no surprise to me when I finally understood that he was the most beautiful person I had seen in all my life.
Nicholas Britell, welcome to Fresh Air. Congratulations on your Oscar nomination. That music is so beautiful that we heard under that scene, and it's so fitting for her recalling this beautiful time in her life about a person who she's so in love with. The music you composed for this movie isn't the music that the characters would be listening to. The music they or their parents would be listening to, like Coltrane or Miles, Nina Simone, I think I heard Al Green in the background.
Yes.
are played on records that they're listening to. Beale Street, from which the title derives, and Harlem, where the film is set, they're both famous for jazz. So it must have been a very conscious decision not to write a jazz score. So tell us about that decision.
You know, my goal is to try to find a sound that hopefully feels like it resonates in some way with the movie. And I find oftentimes that sound isn't necessarily something that seems clear at first. You know, with Beale Street, it's my second chance to work with Barry Jenkins. And, you know, one of the wonderful things that we get the chance to do is we talk before he shoots the film, actually. So Barry on Beale Street said to me that he was hearing the sound of brass and horns. That was really what he said. You know, and I think there was an idea of jazz and mid-20th century jazz, but he said, you know, I'm hearing brass and horns. And so I went off and, you know, started experimenting with trumpets and flugelhorns and cornet and French horns. And I remember I wrote some music and hadn't seen any footage. And then I played the pieces for Barry, just a couple pieces, and he loved them. But when we put them up against some early sequences of the movie, it just wasn't quite right. It was definitely missing something. And, you know, through our process and through, you know, exploring the film together, we discovered that if I actually took that music that I had written for brass and started writing it for cellos in particular, that is how we sort of opened this door to this feeling of love. And this, you know, the cellos really became for us this symbol of love, because the movie is about love and injustice.
I still want to know why you didn't do something that was more specifically jazz.
And I think that in the world of the characters in the film, I knew that Barry was interested in having on the record player, for example, Miles Davis Blue and Green or John Coltrane, you know, I Wish I Knew. And for me, I think there is, you know, there's always this question of, you know, do you want to hear what you're seeing in a sense? You know, like we, you know, in some places in certain films, you know, you the music, the score will enhance what you're seeing. But I often find that when you hear something that may be different than what you're seeing, it almost gives you this, almost like neurologically, like you hear something that's different, and so your brain kind of creates a new association in a way.
If I'm hearing it correctly, the opening line of that theme is in a minor key, but the last note on that first line is like a major chord.
So it's interesting you bring that up because that, you know, I'm very I guess you could say I'm sort of obsessed with the feelings that different harmonies can give us. And the opening chord in that piece is a it's interesting because it's a C minor 7 chord, but it's actually in an inversion. So in a way, it kind of functions as both almost a major or a minor. And there are a lot of moments in the score where I'm kind of playing with both of those.
So the music you wrote for Beale Street, it strikes me that you didn't want the music to overpower the characters. I'm going to compare that to music that you wrote for Vice, the Adam McKay movie about Dick Cheney, and I want to play like the opening credit theme. For Vice, and it's a very turbulent theme. You know, it's piano, and you know, it becomes increasingly discordant as it goes on, and you know, it basically says like things aren't going to be going quite right.
Exactly.
So let's hear the opening credit theme from Vice, and this music is composed by my guest Nicholas Britell, and the movie is nominated for an Oscar for Best Film. Part of the opening credit music from the film Vice, music composed by my guest Nicholas Britell. So I love that piece of music. I'd listen to that in a concert hall.
Thank you.
So tell us about what you were trying to do with it.
So that actually was the last thing I wrote for Vice before we finished the film. And from the very beginning, you know, I'd talked to Adam McKay, our director of Vice, and I'd first worked with Adam on The Big Short. And from early on, his first ideas, you know, we were talking about those first ideas that kind of, you know, you receive this guidance from a director when they have an instinct. And his instinct was, this story is so large. You know, not only is Vice the story of Dick Cheney, this man and his rise through Washington and the repercussions of his actions, it's also really the story of America over the past 50, 60 years. And thus, it's clearly also the story of America's impact on the world over those years. So this is such a large story that Adam felt, you know, we need a symphonic scope. It has to be, you know, we should have a large, why don't you write a symphony, you know, for this movie? And that's a, you know, it's an amazing opportunity, but it's also a question of, well, what does that symphony sound like? Like, were I to write a symphony? And so I thought to myself, you know, I think we have in our, you know, back of our minds a sense of, is there an American symphonic sound? You know, I think there are certain things that we may think of when someone says that. What's an American symphonic sound? And I think there's also an idea we have of like a hero's journey. What does a hero's journey sound like? You know, maybe it's a brass fanfare or something like that. But I felt right away that this isn't that movie. You know, this is a movie that has dissonance to it. It's, the dissonance has to be integral and woven into the nature of the notes themselves. So I actually started to experiment with ideas where I could take a melodic idea, let's say, and what if I inserted the, quote, wrong notes? You know, what if I said, here's a heroic theme, but these notes are wrong, so we're constantly feeling a rub. You know, there's a dissonance somewhere. And I actually use dissonance as a sort of a guiding principle where every piece in the score has a dissonance.
Well, let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. If you're just joining us, my guest is Nicholas Bertel, and he writes movie music. He composed the score for If Beale Street Could Talk, and he's nominated for an Oscar for that. He composed the music for the current film Vice, and Vice is nominated for an Oscar for Best Picture. He was also nominated for an Oscar for the score for Moonlight. We're going to hear more of his music after we come back. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is Nicholas Bertel. He's nominated for an Oscar for composing the score for If Beale Street Could Talk. He also wrote the score for the current film Vice about Dick Cheney, and that film is nominated for Best Picture. He was also nominated for an Oscar for Moonlight. Let's talk about writing the score for Moonlight. The first thing I want to do is play the theme, and I should say, there's three different versions of this theme because the film is about three different chapters in this character's life. And the character, early on in the film, in chapter one, he's a young African-American boy growing up in Florida. His mother is a crack addict. And he's a small and very, very quiet boy. There's a lot going on beneath the surface, but he doesn't say very much. So this is his theme. The violin is played so quietly and tentatively. It's very much like the boy who's afraid or too afraid or too shy or too inhibited to really speak much. And it's like the violinist is almost afraid to fully bow the strings, to fully like connect with the strings.
That's such a great point that you bring that up, because that really was what I was going for there. The violin's played by Tim Fain, who's just a stunning violinist. And the way we recorded it actually was we put the violin very, very close to the mic, and I asked Tim to basically play the notes as quietly as he possibly could while still having the confidence of the note feeling, you know, because you can play it so quietly that it loses some of its inner strength. But so he found this pressure where it was just at the point where it felt confident, and yet it was so quiet. And because it was close mic, you had the sound of the bow hair. You know, I like keeping, in a lot of recordings actually, really as almost an aesthetic choice, I like hearing the sound of the instruments and hearing the, you know, hearing the noises and the textures that instruments make, you know, hearing the air in the room, hearing the, you know, I think that makes it feel real and beautiful to me. And so then I took the violin that we'd recorded very closely and I ran it through some reverb where there's actually a subtle amount of very long-tailed reverb on it too, which just gives the violin this extra feeling of, I don't know, almost like a mist or something around the notes. And I think, you know, there is that feeling of tenderness, hopefully. There's this feeling of, you know, there's an intimacy that I wanted that to feel like. And Tim just played that so beautifully. And that became, in a way, you know, once we knew Little's theme connected with the picture, then it became the question of how do we evolve this over the course of the movie? You know, where do we go from there? And that was when Barry and I really began more fully exploring this idea of chopped and screwed music, which was one of the first.
Explain what chopped and screwed is.
Sure, sure. So in these early conversations I had with Barry, he was telling me about how much he loves chopped and screwed music, which is a style of Southern hip hop where you take a recording and you slow it down. And when you slow the recording down, the pitch goes down. And what it does to the audio texture is that it just deepens and enriches it. And Barry loves listening to music that's been chopped and screwed. And, you know, it's incredible when you hear music that's chopped and screwed. It just completely, it's the same, but it's different. And it actually, in a way, by slowing things down and enriching it, you have this, it almost makes the music have an even deeper gravitas to it. And so we had this idea of what if I were to write a score for Moonlight? What if I was going to write and record the music? And then what would happen if I actually chopped and screwed my own recordings that I made? And again, you know, that's one of those, it sounds cool, it's an interesting idea, but ultimately the test is, does it work for the movie? You know, is it right for the picture? Does it tell us something latent within the movie? And we discovered that it did work, and Barry got so excited about these possibilities. And so I started taking my themes and the music that I was writing and chopping and screwing them, so saying, well, what if I take this and what if I slow this down? And what if, where does this track go if I really, you know, screw it down and it's like this incredibly distorted texture?
So we've made a mix of two of the three versions of the theme that you have. Again, there's three chapters of the movie, one where the main character is a young boy, one where he's in high school, and one after he's gotten out of prison. That's the part that we're hearing after he's gotten out of jail and after he's become a drug dealer. So the first part of this mix is going to be what a short excerpt of what we just heard a little earlier. And then it's going to go into the chopped and screwed version where everything is slowed down and becomes deeper as well. And I think maybe you've added some instruments on top of it too.
So Black's theme is actually orchestrated for cellos. And it's in the same key as Little's theme, but it is then chopped and screwed down. So it's in D major, which is where Little's theme is, and then it's actually pitched down to A.
Okay. And the second version sounds not only like it has more gravitas, which is, I think, the word that you used, but it also sounds mournful.
Yeah.
It sounds sad. So let's hear it. So this is the chapter one version of the theme, and the chapter three is an adult version of the theme.
Thank you.
That's really beautiful.
Thank you.
So are you interested in the French Impressionist composers? I almost feel like I hear Satie in that.
Oh, you know what? That era is such a beautiful moment in time, and I love the sort of, that you're probably thinking of, like the gymnopédie, you know, those like those like miniatures, you know. I think also there's an element almost of sometimes if I'm thinking back on, you know, the things that feel like there's almost like a mazurka, like almost like a Chopin mazurka kind of miniature feeling to, you know, sometimes there's a, I always am drawn, I think, to composers who also have that kind of tenderness, I think, in their approach. You know, with Satie, there really was that simplicity that I thought was so beautiful. And, you know, obviously, I think in the 19th century, classical music took on such gargantuan proportions at times. And I love when composers go in the opposite direction and there's actually this purity or simplicity to it. Mozart would do that too, where, you know, he would have a piece where it could be just a few notes. You know, sometimes that's, for me, even more powerful than if there are 1,000 notes.
My guest is composer Nicholas Britell. His score for If Beale Street Could Talk is nominated for an Oscar. He also wrote the score for Vice, which is nominated for Best Picture. We'll talk more and hear more of his music after a break. And John Powers will review the new Netflix drama series, Black Earth Rising, about the search for justice after the Rwandan genocide. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance with the Name Your Price tool, offering a range of coverage and price options to choose from. Now that's Progressive. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. And from Americans for the Arts, committed to transforming America's communities through the arts and arts education. Supporting the nonprofit arts industry, which employs 4.6 million people nationwide. Learn more at AmericansForTheArts.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to my interview with Nicholas Britell. He's nominated for an Oscar for his score for the film If Beale Street Could Talk. He wrote the score for Vice, which is nominated for Best Picture. His score for Moonlight was nominated for an Oscar. He also wrote the theme for the HBO series Succession and the score for The Big Short. When you were in Harvard, you studied psychology and you studied neuromusicology, which means basically studying how music works on the brain and therefore how music works on you when you're listening. Are there principles of neuromusicology that you learned that you've applied as a composer?
You know, yeah, when I was in school, I was a psychology concentrator, and I'd always been fascinated with questions of, you know, why do certain chords feel a certain way, or do they feel a certain way? You know, asking with the really sort of deep questions of, like, what is music and why does it impact us at all? Because I think there are these, you know, music is so ever-present in our lives today that I think sometimes we almost take for granted how mysterious it is that there are these, you know, vibrations in the air, these frequencies that combine that, you know, hit our ears and that we then create deep complexes of emotion out of. You know, it's this incredibly mysterious thing that we really don't know that much about. And, You know, with neuromusicology specifically, I mean, there are so many interesting questions. And actually, I think it's only deepened the mystery for me. It hasn't clarified things. It actually made me have more questions, where I think growing up, I used to think, for example, that a major chord was happy and a minor chord was sad. And now I don't. I actually think that it's all about context. And I think that sometimes the saddest music is with major chords, and the most inspiring music that feels like true perseverance can be with minor chords.
You studied piano, classically trained. You went to Juilliard's pre-college program. For a while, you hoped to be a concert pianist. So when you chose not to become a concert pianist, it's not like you immediately became a film composer. You spent some time as a currency trader on Wall Street. And that is not a direct route from concert pianist. It's a really, to me, inexplicable detour that your life took. So please explain how you went from deciding, yeah, I'm not going to be a concert pianist, to being a currency trader, and exactly what credentials did you have to become one?
That's a great question. So when I was in college, the way in which I got started with film music and really furthered my own music was I joined a hip-hop band that friends of mine had started and called the Witness Protection Program. And I was passionate about the band and actually wrote so much music over those years. And exactly at that same period of time when I was writing so much music for the band, my very dear friend Nick Lavelle, who tragically passed away a few years ago, who's an amazing director, he asked me if I had ever scored a film and would I like to score the $10,000 feature film that he was making while we were at Harvard. And I said, let's do it. Let's try it out. So in college, my whole life was really scoring Nick's film and, you know, playing with my band all the time. And at the end of college, the movie didn't come out and it wasn't clear when it was going to come out. I thought, you know, maybe this movie will come out in 6 months or a year, you know, so that wasn't very clear what was happening. And then the band broke up, you know, and we decided to part ways. And at that moment, I actually interviewed with someone who had gone to Harvard who himself was a composer. And he worked in finance. And he said, you know what, you know, we can find something for you to do. So I ended up, he ended up hiring me, and I learned to trade currencies and was exposed to this whole other world of international finance. And, you know, we focused on currencies and emerging market currencies specifically and interest rates. And while I was doing that during the day, I was scoring short films. I would give concerts even. Actually, I gave a concert for our investors. You know, I would do that. I would write all Oh, yeah. I would write all sorts of music. I wrote telephone hold music, you know.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. I remember writing telephone hold music and having a friend of mine who got me the gig. He was like, do you want to do this? I was like, absolutely. And I wrote this kind of almost like spa-like music. And all my friends would call this restaurant and ask to be placed on hold. So that was, you know, but you know, I loved it. I just loved writing music.
You worked for the investment bank Bear Stearns. Mm-hmm. And this was a bank that kind of, that collapsed at the start of the financial meltdown of 2007 and 2008. Were you working for Bear Stearns when it collapsed?
So I worked in the asset management division, and we had our own fund, actually. So we were under the umbrella of Bear Stearns, but we functioned sort of very, very separately. But our, you know, our office was in the Bear Stearns building, and I was there, you know, during the crisis. And it was an interesting position to be in, for sure, because, you know, we were operating this strategy that was separate from what the bank was doing, but at the same time, we were there. You know, seeing that up close was certainly something I won't ever forget.
I imagine there was an atmosphere of utter panic.
There was, I think, an atmosphere of shock. I think a lot of things, you know, that's sort of the nature of financial markets in a sense. You know, they're stable until they aren't. And, there was sort of a metaphor sometimes people would say in the markets where, you know, it's like escalator up, elevator down, you know, and I think that's how it felt, where you know, all of a sudden the whole system felt to be at risk.
When Adam McKay, when the director and writer Adam McKay hired you to do the music for The Big Short, a movie that combines comedy and drama to tell the story of how the financial markets collapsed and how the economy collapsed, he didn't know that you knew the language of Wall Street. He didn't know that you'd been a currency trader. And so how did he find out, and what was his reaction?
It's a funny story, actually, because, you know, that's correct. Like, I had read the script. Jeremy Kleiner, the producer, one of the producers of The Big Short, had sent me the script, and I loved the book, The Big Short, and Michael Lewis is so brilliant. And I remember talking to Jeremy before I read the script and saying, how are you going to make this into a movie? And when I read the script, I knew immediately, you know, Adam had such an insight into that story, into the way he wanted to make the movie. But you're right, Adam hired me because he had heard my music and really liked it. And we had an early conversation where he said to me, what do you think the sound of dark math is? And I had an idea, and I recorded it and sent it to him, and he kind of hired me immediately, actually, still having no idea that I knew anything about finance. But what happened was, one day Jeremy said to me, you know, if you have any notes on the script, you know, just general thoughts on, you know, inaccuracies or whatever, you know, details, feel free to send them over. And I was like, are you sure? Like, I mean, I'm happy to look at it, but do you really, you know? And he said, yeah, sure, send them over. So, you know, I went through and sent some notes over. And much later on, Adam told me that he called Jeremy and was like, why on earth is our composer sending me financial notes on our script? And Jeremy was like, oh, you know, he actually, you know, worked in finance and traded currencies, et cetera. So that was how Adam found out that I had, it was much after the fact. And I was very happy because I wouldn't have wanted to be hired because I worked in finance. I would only want to work on the film if Adam thought my music was right for it.
Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. If you're just joining us, my guest is Nicholas Britell. He's nominated for an Oscar for composing the score for If Beale Street Could Talk, and he composed the score for the current film Vice, which is nominated for an Oscar for Best Film. He also wrote the score for Moonlight. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Home Advisor, matching homeowners with home improvement professionals for a variety of home projects, from minor repairs to major remodels. Homeowners can read reviews of local pros and book appointments online at homeadvisor.com. And from the Alliance for Lifetime Income, a nonprofit composed of financial services organizations working to educate Americans about options for securing protected lifetime income in retirement. More at AllianceForLifetimeIncome.org.
This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is composer Nicholas Britell, who's known for his film scores. He's nominated for an Oscar for his score for If Beale Street Could Talk. He wrote the score for the new film Vice, which is nominated for an Oscar for Best Picture. He also wrote the score for Moonlight and The Big Short. So I want to play part of the music that you wrote for The Big Short. And this is the opening music. In the film, there's a voiceover by Ryan Gosling who's talking about, like, the old days of Wall Street when, you know, investment banking was a kind of, like, boring business. It was a boring, slow world. And so here's the music that you wrote to accompany that voiceover about the boring business of banking in the old days.
Thank you.
That's music from the film The Big Short. That is so unlike what we've been hearing. What were you thinking of when you wrote this? I'll start by saying it's a kind of old-fashioned waltz.
Yes, exactly.
And like very like middle of the road, almost like sedated, you know, like a like yeah, you take it from there.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I think there was an idea of what I talked about with Adam was this feeling of almost like old Americana. You know, back in the day, Wall Street was boring. It was sleepy, in a way, maybe as it should be. You know, I think, you know, I definitely am of the view that certain industries, especially when they are so, you know, crucial to the functioning of the world and the economy, maybe they should be a little boring. You know, maybe they should be like the utility system. You know, you don't want the public utility system to be exciting. I think, if the electrical grid was exciting all the time, maybe that would be bad. So banking was boring. And there was this idea of just that old, sort of old sound, old Americana waltz, sleepy waltz. And then Adam said to me, I wrote that piece, and Adam said, maybe there should be one thing that's just weird. Like, how do we make it a little weird? And so there's this sound I did of a electric keyboard, like a Wurlitzer, that I ran through a tape, like a wild sort of tape filter that gave it this almost kind of like bizarro alien kind of sound. So there's this very boring waltz, but right in the middle of it, there's some strangeness kind of just seeding that idea that maybe things are going somewhere different.
Is that music that we just heard from The Big Short anything like the hold music that you wrote? For when people are put on hold.
That's funny. It isn't, and I recently went back and tried to find that hold music.
I want to hear that so bad.
I was curious about it. The hold music I wrote, I remember, was much more like the music you'd hear at a spa. It was like spa music. You know, it was that kind of like very sort of almost like twinkly kind of piano and very delicate, you know, soothing texture. So not worlds away from this, but not as musically structured in a way there, where the boring old banking track has sort of a progression, and you know, I would say the whole music was more sort of had a stasis to it.
That kind of spa music just really drives me crazy because I know it's supposed to calm me down, but I find it like really irritating because I don't like the music.
Well, if I find my hold music, I will send it to you. Maybe mine won't, you know, bother you. But you never know. You never know. I don't know.
So I just have to ask you, what were your goals? Because whenever you write, you're writing with a goal, with an emotional and narrative mission in mind. So when you were writing hold music, what was your goal?
My goal was to, you know, make your experience on hold as pleasurable as possible. I think it really was to, you know, if you have to be on hold, you know, you might as well have some music that, you know, doesn't make you want to, you know, hang up the phone too quickly. So I was hoping that if it was this sort of soothing atmosphere, maybe, you know, maybe theoretically it would make your time on hold more enjoyable.
There was a period when I was flying a lot, and so I knew the U.S. Air, which is no longer existing under that name. But I knew the U.S. Air hold music by heart, and it was so irritating.
Oh, no. You know, yeah, I think sometimes there is the potential irony of things that are designed to soothe that are very problematic. I've had that experience where you go to a spa, and if the music is not quite right, it actually really takes away from the relaxation of the of the experience, but my hope was, knowing all of that, to create something that might be relaxing.
One of the things you've composed is the score for HBO's series Succession, which is about an older media mogul who may be entering the early stages of dementia, and his sons and daughter are competing to see who's going to inherit the empire and gain control over it. So this is a very kind of turbulent theme. Before we hear it, say a few words about writing it.
I think the thing that excited me about working for Succession was to create something that had, on the one hand, a gravitas to it, because we have to take this world seriously because it's real to a large extent, but also there is an absurdity to it, and to the feeling that I think I wanted. So the opening track has a massive hip hop beat, and then there's this sort of almost slightly out of tune piano that almost feels like crazy circus music or something, you know. So that was the, those are the many different tonalities I think I was going for.
And was it hard for you to work within the confines? I guess it wasn't, because you do movie music all the time, but a theme has to be a certain amount of time exactly.
I love that, actually. I feel that restrictions are very liberating in that sense creatively. So, you know, I think sometimes when you get these I like these types of assignments where they say, here, you have 90 seconds, do this.
Nicholas Britell, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for your music.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really a pleasure.
That's the theme for the HBO series Succession, composed by Nicholas Britell. His score for If Beale Street Could Talk is nominated for an Oscar. After we take a short break, John Powers will review the new Netflix drama series Black Earth Rising, about the search for justice during and after the Rwandan genocide. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. The new Netflix series, Black Earth Rising, stars Michaela Cole as a Rwandan exile and John Goodman as an American human rights lawyer who investigate war crimes committed during and after the 1994 Rwandan genocide. Our critic at large, John Powers, says that it's a superbly acted show about the search for justice.
There are events so horrific, we'd rather not think about them. One that much of the world has largely forgotten is the Rwandan genocide, whose 25th anniversary is this April. As Western leaders stood idly by, 800,000 members of the minority Tutsi tribe were murdered by the majority Hutus, who'd been whipped into a homicidal frenzy by their leaders. The fallout from this killing spree is the subject of a clunky but fascinating BBC drama, Black Earth Rising, just out on Netflix. It was made by Hugo Blick, whose award-winning 2014 series, The Honorable Woman, used a deliriously serpentine plot to explore the Israeli-Palestinian conundrum. He's up to the same tricks in this new 8-part series, which offers us the gaudy goodies of a thriller, you know, murders and chases and shocking revelations, in order to interest us in a tragedy whose aftershocks are still rocking Africa today. Rising British star Michaela Cole stars as Kate Ashby, a 30-ish Rwandan who, as a little girl, was rescued from the 1994 genocide by human rights lawyer Eve Ashby. That's Harriet Walter, who adopted her and raised her in London. Eve and her American boss, Michael Ennis, that's John Goodman, are dedicated to prosecuting those who turn Central Africa into a killing field. All of which is fine until Eve goes after a Tutsi general who, after helping end the genocide, went on to commit war crimes in neighboring Congo. Kate is outraged. How can her own mom go after a man who saved Tutsis like herself from slaughter? This tricky question gets even trickier once Kate finds herself working with Michael on a second case, this time defending a Rwandan minister from a war crimes charge brought by the French. As the two cases cross-pollinate, Black Earth Rising races from London mansions to Congolese mining camps, from Parisian police stations to the presidential offices in the Rwandan capital of Kigali. Meanwhile, Kate, whose childhood trauma keeps her inner life churning, burns with a righteous anger that blinds her to the past's full complexity. Here, she challenges Michael for letting her mother prosecute that Tutsi general, named Simon Nyamoya.
It isn't your world.
The Congo?
The genocide.
I prosecuted one of the first cases for the ICTR in 98. Your mother was my junior. It's where we met. I'd go so far as to say it's why you're here.
And I don't want to go back to any of it, ever.
Do you think your mother loves you, Kate? You think she'd ever do anything to harm you?
It's a silly question.
It is. So why do you keep asking it? Your mother's one of the most steadfast and loyal people I have ever met, and most of that has been directed at you. She's also one of the smartest. So if she's chosen to prosecute Simon Nyamoya, I trust her to do it. Let her do her job, Kate.
Now, Black Earth Rising is decidedly not one of those current events potboilers like Bodyguard or Homeland. It cares less about ratcheting things up than reminding us that history is vast, messy, and ever-changing. Kate's exploration of her past helps us understand the Rwanda genocide and its violent aftermath. We get details of how Belgian and French policies helped fuel the killing, and how colonialism still works today. We see how the Tutsi leaders who currently run Rwanda have created an orderly but dictatorial state. And more abstractly, we see how hard it is to define justice in a world where one-time heroes start doing bad things, and fate transforms villains into victims. Of course, it would take a lifetime to capture the complexity of all these things, and Black Earth Rising is only an 8-hour TV series. Although Blick tries hard to do justice to his subject, his ambition has a cost. The dramatic side of the series can be wobbly. Some of the dialogue is thuddingly expository. Some of the plot twists feel mechanical. Some of the symbolism is overbearing. And our heroine, Kate, is less a three-dimensional character than a walking emblem of Central African trauma. Yet Cole plays Kate with such incandescent intensity that she keeps us riveted anyway. In fact, the whole series is superbly acted. There's a winningly ambiguous turn by Lucien Samati as the confidant of Rwanda's president, and a brilliant one by Goodman, who in Michael aces a dream role. He gets to play smart, witty, soulful, and heck, even sexy. In the show's opening credits, we hear Leonard Cohen performing his song You Want It Darker in his incomparable Hound of Hell growl. Yet Black Earth Rising is actually about seeking the light. As Kate learns the buried truth about the past, her own and her home country's, she begins to escape its clutches, transforming herself from an innocent, victimized by history, into a wised-up woman who's trying to make it.
John Powers reviewed the new Netflix series Black Earth Rising. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, we'll talk about the new 5G network that is being constructed and will be the new central nervous system of the Internet. But China's telecom giant Huawei is dominating the creation of 5G networks around the world, which could give China more access for cyber espionage and hacking. My guest will be David Sanger, a national security correspondent for The New York Times and the author of a book about cyber war. I hope you'll join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our associate producer for digital media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Creative Planning, an independent wealth management firm taking a financial planning-led approach to managing clients' investments at creativeplanning.com/NPR. Creative Planning, wealth management redefined. From Indeed, used by over 3 million businesses for hiring, where employers can post jobs and use screener questions to build their short list of preferred candidates. Learn more at Indeed.com/hire. And from Americans for the Arts.